everybody. You know, every week, I start off by saying, we got a great one, you know, for a change. And I think you figured out by now that when I'm saying that, I'm almost always lying. Not this week, because my guests are Carol Lenig of The Washington Post, who, with her writing partner, Phil Rucker, have written two number one New York Times bestsellers on the Trump presidency, A Very Stable Genius and I Alone Can Fix It. And she's been covering the investigation into the January 6th storming of the Capitol by the House Select Committee. Joining Carol and myself is Ryan Riley, who has much the same beat for NBC News. And we will be talking about the televised hearings that are starting this coming Thursday in prime time and what we can expect. Now, Congressman Jamie Raskin, who did this podcast a couple months ago, has since said that the hearings will, quote, blow the roof off the Capitol. So what potential bombshells will Americans be hearing about Trump's role in the attempted coup? There will be testimony to the fact that on January 6th, when Trump was watching TV in the White House, that he kind of liked the idea of the mob hanging Mike Pence. There will be testimony from a number of administration officials, including Attorney General Bill Barr, that they told Trump he had lost the election and that he knew he lost the election. Meanwhile, I just a word on how much I hate the NRA, the gun lobby, my former Republican colleagues who refuse to acknowledge that there is no reason for Americans to be carrying around assault weapons. And to be such transparent assholes about it. Here's Ted Cruz, right after the mass murder of fourth graders in Uvalde, talking to a British reporter.
There are 19 sets of parents who are never going to get to kiss their child goodnight again.
Okay, I wish you could see his face as he's trying to act like he's really moved and saying something profound. There's 19 sets of parents who will never get to kiss their child goodnight again. I'm sorry, but it just sounds just so smarmy. Let's go on.
Is this the moment to reform gun laws?
You know, it's easy to go to politics.
Okay, I think this was about the assault weapons that had just killed 19 children whose parents will never get to kiss their kids goodnight because you and your Republican colleagues still think it's okay for anybody to get an assault weapon and kill 21 people. It is a political issue. And by the way, Ted Cruz has received over $400,000 in campaign contributions from gun lobbyists.
But it's important. It's at the heart of the issue.
I get that that's where the media likes to go.
Okay, once again, this is Ted saying, oh, this is what, it's just politics and the media's ratings and clickbait. It has nothing to do with the fact that we have all these mass shootings in this country. In this country. Now, when Australia banned assault weapons after a terrible mass shooting, since then, they have not had one.
It's not. It's where many of the people we've talked to here like to go.
The proposals from Democrats in the media, inevitably, when some violent psychopath murders people.
A violent psychopath who's able to get a weapon so easily. 18-year-old with two AR-15s.
If you want to stop violent crime, the proposals the Democrats have, none of them would have stopped this.
Yeah, they would have. After Sandy Hook, I signed on to co-sponsor the assault weapons ban along with almost every Democrat. And by the way, I have a gun buyback program that I think would get rid of a lot of assault weapons, take them off the street. Hand in an AR-15, you get 1,000 OxyContin. Okay, let's pick this up.
But why does this only happen in your country? I really think that's what many people around the world just, they cannot fathom. Why only in America? Why is this American exceptionalism so awful?
You know, I'm sorry you think American exceptionalism is awful.
That's my favorite. How lame, how shameless is that pivot? Oh, I'm sorry you think American exceptionalism is awful. Okay, it goes on.
I think this aspect of it.
You get your political agenda.
No, it's honestly,
God love you.
Senator, it's not. I just want to understand why you do not think that guns are the problem.
Okay, and then Cruz just walks off. Of course, 2 days later, Cruz speaks at the NRA convention. Now, by then, we knew that 19 Valdi policemen refused to execute their training and waited to confront the shooter for over an hour, costing a number of children their lives. And then Ted Cruz at the NRA convention said this.
Ultimately, as we all know, what stops armed bad guys is armed good guys.
That is what happens when you lock a speech a week before the event and forget to rewrite. Okay, I got that off my chest. Stay tuned. We got Carol Lenig and Ryan Riley, and we discuss the upcoming January 6th hearings. It's a great one. You know. Finally. Carol Lenig is joining us. She's an investigative reporter for the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winner, MSNBC contributor, author, with Phil Rucker, of some New York Times bestsellers, two New York Times bestsellers. That's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you. It was a little hair-raising for a while there, but it was they were fun books to do.
Now, let me ask you something. I just said they're New York Times bestsellers. Is it irritating to you that I didn't say they're number one New York Times bestsellers, which they were, because the distinction is so huge?
No. It wasn't irritating. I'll tell you honestly, Al. the thing that was irritating is I actually have three New York Times bestsellers. So instead of two, there were three.
Okay. I should have known that. Were two of them, was the third one a number one New York Times bestseller?
It was a number two.
Okay, well, you know, so what? Ryan Riley is with me, justice reporter for NBC News. How many number one New York Times? Okay, this is how we roll here on the Al Franken podcast. Today we're going to be discussing the Select Committee, January 6th Select Committee's public hearings that are going to be coming up. They're starting Thursday, June 9th. So we'll be dropping this on Sunday, June 5th, and this coming Thursday will be in prime time, right?
That's the understanding. Yeah, they're going to have two sort of prime time hearings, and then in the middle, they're going to have the daytime hearings. So I think they're starting off with a prime time hearing.
Now, what does that mean in terms of prime time? Is it prime time on C-SPAN or is it prime time on all the networks? I mean, that's a big difference, because you hear prime time, you go, wow. And then you go, oh, it's on. What does it mean?
You know, what's interesting about this, just, you know, in general, is that so much of this is focused on the media coverage and the reaction. Like, a lot of the strategy that they've been talking is about how we can make sure that this breaks through, how it gets the audience that it deserves, right? And it's just sort of fascinating, because it's almost like members of this committee are like sort of, you know, A-B-ing and doing audience testing. It's like kind of like they're like reporters in a certain way, like, oh, how can we make sure that this has the most impact? And you wonder if like how how recent of a development that is, in terms of, I don't think that the Watergate folks are necessarily worried about whether or not their material was going to break through, right? Like, it was just like, here's what we got, let's lay it out, everyone will cover it, and that's sort of that, right? There was a lot less division, I think, in those days, when you could just sort of put something out and everyone would cover it, and we'd have this shared understanding together as a country of what happened.
How long were those hearings? Because they went on, those televised hearings went on for quite a while. I mean, they're assuming we're going to do, how many did you say, six of these?
Yep.
Two in prime time. And again, do you know the answer to that? Are they going to be on NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN? I mean, or are they just going to be on CNN and Fox? And Fox won't carry them. MSNBC. Where are they going to be in prime time? What does that mean, prime time?
I think their goal is to get them, you know, it's obviously up to the networks which ones cover them, but I think their goal is to get as much coverage of this as possible. And I would suspect that we're going to have pretty intense coverage, at least on, you know, the cable news networks, for certainly those, that first and last hearing. But yeah, I mean, like, that's, I mean, they basically just want to get as large of an audience as they can. And I think that this is going to be a multimedia.
So they're not
going
to, like, NBC is not going to preempt Mass Singer.
I haven't been privy to those discussions. Might be a little bit above my pay grade at NBC Universal, but I don't know if it's going to, I'm not sure exactly when, what they're going to break through for some of this.
Now, Carol, what night is Mass Singer? Because I don't know.
Oh, I don't know either. But I think what's most important,
I
that Ryan,
I had knowledgeable.
Yeah,
guess.
Really, we're really failing you on this central question. But I think the most important thing is to focus on that phrase Ryan used, which is breakthrough. I mean, you make the comparison that's smart, Al, about the Watergate hearings, which went on for weeks, and nobody was thinking, you know, how do we spin or emphasize key points in our presentation. Whereas I think in this instance, because our country is now so divided, now there's an echo chamber, a Fox News echo chamber, and a MSNBC echo chamber. There's a real anxiety on the part of the committee to make sure that this pierces the blood-brain barrier for people who don't want to hear that Donald Trump did something unpleasant, untoward, or possibly seditious. You know, there's a huge part of America that doesn't believe that the people who attacked the Capitol on January 6th were criminals, when indeed all the evidence on videotape is that they were. There was a series of felonies being committed and attacks on police. And I think what this committee's challenge is and what they're trying to make other people understand who are resisting it is this was violent. This was organized. And this was essentially a fire that Donald Trump lit the match for.
And that's going to be, I think, one of the big distinctions is what that means, that he lit the match for. Now, Jamie Raskin, who was the House manager for the impeachment in the Senate, has said that these hearings are going to blow the roof off the Capitol. That's kind of promising a lot. Now, to be clear to my audience, he didn't say that the people who stormed the Capitol had planned to blow the roof off the Capitol.
Right.
He said that the reaction to this, well, so that's kind of promising a lot. So what are you looking for example, in this first hour, or I don't know how long these hearings are going to be, but what are you looking for? What should they do right at the start of this? Should they drop a few bombshells right at the beginning? I mean, when he's saying this is going to blow the roof off the Capitol, that seems to me to be saying they're going to connect Donald Trump to what happened, more than just that he inspired them to do this, but that he was in on the planning of it.
So I'm keen to hear what Ryan's interpretation of this is, but, you know, I'm not a crisis communicator manager. I am not a spin doctor, but I am a reporter. And what I hear from inside sources are a couple of things about what this committee aims to do in the early stages of their hearings and presentation. They will have lined up real narrators who lived through these days before January 6th, during January 6th, and immediately after the attack, narrating in their own first person front seat view lens what happened, what they heard inside the White House, what they heard inside the Capitol, and what they heard from principals that they worked for or worked alongside or served. And so I think you can imagine that you'll hear, for example, from people who were giving advice to Vice President Pence as Donald Trump was trying to bully him into refusing to certify the election on January 4th, a lobby campaign that went on for many days. You're going to hear from police who were attacked on January 6th, and you're going to hear from people who were near President Trump as he was planning essentially what he wanted to happen that day. Obviously, we all know what he wanted Vice President Pence to do, But then he was going for a Hail Mary of having his supporters do something, exert some pressure on the Capitol. And I think you're going to hear, again, first-person witnesses describing what Trump said he wanted. Most recently, we've heard in a very good New York Times report that President Trump indicated on the day of the attack some support or some happiness at the idea that his supporters on January 6th were calling for the hanging of the vice president.
Now, these are people presumably who are in the White House during those 3 hours he did nothing and that he didn't call us off. And what I understand is that these are witnesses who said that he was kind of giddy or happy that they were talking about hanging Mike Pence. Now, I'd feel a little bad about that if I were Mike Pence. Am I wrong? Or is Mike Pence just that forgiving a guy? I mean, whose idea was it to hang Mike Pence? Whose idea was that?
You know, I think like one thing that's going to be really interesting to explore is the connections between a lot of these extremist groups and the White House, frankly,
yes.
Because I think that that's really where a lot of the key is, right? Because there is just a lot of overlap between people who are in the orbit of in Trump's orbit and people who are in the orbit of the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, which are sort of the two organizations that are at the center.
You know, the Oath Keepers, three of them, right, have pled guilty.
That's right.
To seditious conspiracy. And that's not really a surprise since the Oath Keeper's oath is I solemnly pledge to overthrow the United States government.
Something like that. Yeah, I think that one moment that really sticks out to me during this was a few weeks back when I was covering the third plea agreement hearing, and it was sort of a last minute hearing. This was someone who had been cooperating. This is an Oath Keeper who had been cooperating with the government for a while, comes in and actually does his plea agreement and was going to be testifying before the grand jury the next day. As described in this account and what he told the court, it was this pretty dramatic moment where on January 6th, after leaving the grounds of the Capitol with Stuart Rhodes, who was the head of the Oath Keepers, they went back to this suite at a hotel, and he heard Stuart Rhodes make a call to someone, it's not identified who was in Trump's orbit, apparently some sort of go-between, to try to get in direct contact with Donald Trump that day. Stuart Rhodes wanted to speak with Donald Trump. He wasn't successful in getting through. And what Oath Keepers or the lawyers for the Oath Keepers have said is that he didn't have any direct connections, but he knew a lot of people who knew people. And I think that those connections are going to be really something that both the January 6th committee, as well as federal prosecutors and this federal grand jury are going to be exploring very closely.
Are we talking about a Roger Stone? Are we talking about a Mark Meadows? Who are we?
Well, Mark, so Roger Stone was offered protection by the Oath Keepers. The Oath Keepers were actually escorting Roger Stone around the Capitol the day before January 6th, as well as on the day of. So I think that, you know, that's certainly one of those links that people are going to be looking at very clearly. Roger Stone has denied that he was the person who was on the other end of that call. So you can take that for what you will coming from Roger Stone. But that's, I mean, I think that like those networks are going to be really something that is going to be interesting because there is some overlap between some of the lawyers for Trump efforts that have been going on in this sort of more of this lawyerly effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election and the violent attempt to overthrow the election results on January 6th. There's definitely some overlap in some of the same players who were dealing in both instances. So, you know, I think that it's really interesting when you hear a federal grand jury start exploring around organizers on January 6th because of that just brings up so many red flags within the Justice Department and so many protocols in terms of respecting First Amendment rights, because you can't just sort of investigate something when there are First Amendment protections to holding a rally, for example. So I think that like the number of checks that they had to go through before pursuing this leg of the investigation is really interesting. But of course, the committee can explore a lot more of that without having to worry about so much about the actual what the potential criminal offense might be. They just sort of have
that'd be
more
for
of
the Justice Department.
Correct. Yeah. The restrictions on the Justice Department.
And the Justice Department, what, asked for transcripts of some of the interviews, and the committee wouldn't give it to DOJ or?
Not initially. There is a little bit of tension rising up. And I think that that might be something that's going to be cleared up down the line, especially after these hearings and after sort of if there's any report that they put out. But, you know, those raw materials could be of a lot of value, frankly, to the Justice Department. So that's something that the committee would think would want to have in the Justice Department's hands, because there are a lot of crimes you could prosecute someone for, you know, lying to Congress, for example. That's one way of going about this from a criminal prosecution standpoint.
So why wouldn't the committee hand that over right away? Why would they even question that?
Well, there has been some members of the committee who have been upset with DOJ not going further. But I would, you know, say that this is the largest investigation in FBI history in terms of number of defendants and the gigabytes and terabytes of data that is involved. We now have over 800 people who have been charged in connection with the January 6th attacks. More than 300 guilty pleas, as you said, charges as high as seditious conspiracy. So there is a lot of effort going on here. But frankly, you know, this is a lot for DOJ to deal with, because that's just such a high volume of cases. And we have seen some instances of cracks sort of showing in the armor here in terms of these prosecutions as they go on, with DOJ just essentially being overwhelmed. And they've asked Congress, in fact, for more money to go forward to complete these investigations, because there's just so much work ahead. Citizen Sleuths have identified more than 2,500 people who entered the Capitol building that day. There are still hundreds of people on the FBI's website who assaulted officers outside the Capitol who have yet to be arrested. So this is a long, long road ahead, and DOJ is going to need some more resources, I think, to go through with all of this.
But, you know, one of the most interesting things about that is Democrats especially, but also basically critics of Donald Trump, are now huge critics of the Department of Justice, because you even have federal judges asking, what in the world is going on when you're putting all these resources into prosecuting or at least charging basically trespassers and giving them plea agreements to go away because it's such a huge volume of cases, as Ryan points out. Why are we focusing as a Department of Justice and as a government so much energy on hundreds of low-level, no connection kind of miscreants who got caught up in this mob and got increasingly rabid as they march down Constitution Avenue towards the Capitol at the president's exhortation? Why is all of the energy being poured into that instead of simultaneously having an investigation into the nonviolent conspiracy that was sort of in front of everyone's faces? And that was President Trump, a group of his allies and supporters, lying to the public, perpetrating a fraud upon them that the election had been rigged, although the president had been told multiple times that there was.
Yes, who's going to testify saying, I told the president he lost and he understood that he lost? How many people thus far have said that?
Well, the former attorney general has said that, Bill Barr. I don't know that he'll be a witness, but he and many of his aides were present in Oval Office meetings, as were the president's counsel, the White House counsel, not the president, but the counsel for the White House. They were present for meetings where the president was told repeatedly, there is no such evidence, sir. We do not have anything to give you to suggest that the results would have been changed. And while perpetrating this fraud on the American people, what I'd call Team Trump was engaged in something where there's evidence of a crime, evidence of an effort to mislead the public and use the president's levers of power to stay in power, something that's never happened in our lifetimes.
What kind of smoking gun is going to be needed for there's a certain percentage of Trump MAGA people who will never, no matter what you give them, for example, the Raffensperger tape, will ever, you know, buy that Biden won the election, et cetera. But what needs to happen in these hearings where people go like, oh, okay, one, justice should prosecute the president. And two, you know, he was lying about losing the election, of course. And let's just never have to see this guy again.
My quick answer, and I want to emphasize something, Al, and that is, you know, we are reporters. We're not rallying for a side or another. I'm not pushing for a Department of Justice investigation, but I see the evidence that would have led to the opening of an investigation on a person who was just a normal person and not a former president. But in terms of your question, what's going to break through? Every week during the Trump presidency, as reporters, we imagined that people would be aghast at certain actions that he took. Evidence of him misleading the public, lying to the press, lying to the public. Every week, there would be a new event that we thought would lead Trump supporters to be concerned about a president taking those actions or engaging in that kind of malfeasance. And that never materialized. You know, the president basically asked a head of state to investigate an American citizen, which is in some circumstances, depending on the steps that are taken, is against the law. And that did not lead to his impeachment, and that did not lead to any diminution of his supporters' support for him. So I feel like the challenge for the committee of breaking through will be tricky, very tricky, a very high bar for them to hurdle. And I would say that having some of the president's basically closest allies narrate their concern and their feeling of being gobsmacked and disturbed might be the most compelling part of the case if it's presented.
So if Raskin is saying this is going to blow the roof off the Capitol, he also said this was not a coup directed at the president. It was a coup directed by the president against the vice president and against the Congress. If it's shown, for example, what happens if it's shown that hang Mike Pence was Donald Trump's idea, or he approved that idea, or what is there? I know what you're saying. I thought he was a goner when he said, "I don't like people who were captured," you know, and then there were a million of them where I went, "No, that's got to be it," and I was wrong. Is there anything here that can, what could possibly make enough Americans go like, "Oh my God"?
It's tough to say, but I do think that, like, one thing that I found really compelling in the criminal cases that have come forward so far is just having these individuals who admitted they committed criminal offenses on January 6th, these January 6th rioters, say why they did what they did and just spell it out in plain language. And I sometimes feel like I'm a broken record on this, but to these people who actually believe that the election was stolen, their reaction makes sense, right? Like, if this was truly the crime of the century, that's something that would be a proportional response, right? Like, invading the Capitol, or at least, you know, committing some act of civil disobedience, at least would be a reaction to this idea that there's the crime of the century that happened, that, you know, someone is going to seize power unlawfully in the United States. And you could go up from there. You can justify a lot if you actually believe that this was a coup against Trump, which is what a lot of these folks believed. They actually believe that, you know, millions of people voted, more people voted for Trump, that this was, you know, across state lines and involving different parties, a massive, massive crime. That's truly what a lot of these folks believed. And you hear that in case after case, whether it be in their text messages or just even during their plea agreement hearings. One of the most compelling tapes to me, there's this individual, DJ Rodriguez, Danny Rodriguez out of California. And he went with a bunch of other people from California to DC on January 6th. They brought a bunch of weapons. He had a stun gun. And actually drove that stun gun into the neck of former DC police officer Mike Fanone. And when the FBI arrested him, they interviewed him and they sat him down. And this tape has now come out through the legal process. And they, you know, he basically explained to them that he thought that they were the good guys, that they were going to come out on top, that they were saving the country, and explained the commander in chief had called them to DC. So that's what he thought he had to do. And I think that that logic just sort of follows for a lot of these folks who actually believe these lies about the stolen election, which is what sort of made those lies so dangerous.
Well, those people had to do a gut check. Why did I do this thing? Why did I shoot a stun gun into the neck of an officer? which is a legitimate political discourse, according to Republican National Committee, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is just really disturbing when you see some of these videos. And it is like, you know, to borrow a phrase, there's these alternative facts that have come up on the other side of this, where a lot of people are portraying this idea that the police use too much force against, you know, which, I mean, just doesn't really match up, right? Because the mob invaded the Capitol. So the idea that too much force was used is kind of just, you know, ridiculous on its face if you consider the fact that they were overrun. But that's what a lot of these people are now saying.
Well,
saying,
you know what? It was a good thing I wasn't still there, because I kept two magnums in my desk on the Senate floor with high capacity clips, and I would have just come out shooting at there would have been just a lot of dead Trumpies, and the thing would have been over in a few minutes. That's a joke. I wouldn't have done that. Okay.
There was that report about Lindsey Graham being very upset about the fact that there wasn't more force used. They wanted them to use more force. And, you know, I think that it's just something that, frankly, the Capitol Police aren't used to, right? Like, you often see a lot of these organized events where being arrested is sort of part of this,
right.
the deal, right?
We're going to go in there, we're going to get arrested as a protest because we believe in Martin Luther King and right. Gandhi. That not these people, because they were using bear spray. And look, these cops ended up with traumatic brain injury, broken vertebrae, eyes gouged out, fingers lost. They, you know, some committed suicide. This was unbelievably violent. And I think we're going to hear more about that. We heard some of the police testify before. That was chilling. I mean, the three of us are sitting here going, and I'm asking the question, what could possibly change? You know, is Jamie Raskin promising too much?
Al, I think you keep coming back to that question correctly, because Jamie Raskin, when he made that remark, part of it was right after he released what he thought was some really new information being corroborated. It was really material that was corroborated from the Post reports and from a piece of our book, which was, he said the most chilling words that he had learned in the course of the investigation was when Mike Pence told his Secret Service detail leader, "I'm not getting in that car," because he believed the Secret Service was going to whisk him away. And those are chilling words, and we did report them a good while ago, and the committee has corroborated those with first-person accounts and interviews. What's striking about that moment is that Pence is suspicious that the Secret Service is going to take him away from
the building. So that he can't certify the election.
Now, what we don't know is whether or not, and I'm not trying to make an allegation here, but what we don't know is what the Secret Service was thinking and what coordination they were engaged with the White House. There's something we report in our book in which a top aide to President Trump, who previously was the head of his Secret Service detail and was also ultimately the boss of the Secret Service at that moment, was having a conversation with a vice presidential aide. And the vice presidential aide on January 6th was telling this Secret Service leader, "I know you guys, you're going to whisk him away to Alaska if you can." We don't know. The Secret Service may have wanted to whisk Pence away for his own safety. There are good reasons to get him out of the Capitol while people are chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," and have, you know, hangman's noose and Pence in effigy outside the building. But Pence and his team, at least, were worried and suspicious about a effort to get Pence basically off the property and off the job. But Raskin's comments come when he is also talking about other lawmakers and their role in January 6th. So I think what you're going to see about blow the roof off has to do with Pence a little bit, and also is going to have to do with Republican lawmakers and their meetings with Trump in late December before January 6th, where they sort of crow and boast in different social media posts that they have a plan for January 6th and to make sure that President Trump's election is not really stolen from him.
We'll be right back after this break with Carol Lenig and Ryan Riley. Okay, so we start on Thursday. We don't know how long these primetime broadcasts will be. I guess probably a couple hours, maybe. We don't know, right?
Yeah, we don't have a firm understanding of that yet. I mean, I think they are keeping things relatively tight to a certain extent about how the length of these, but I do think that, you know, this does seem like it's going to be a multimedia presentation to sort of knock people over the head, is I think what they're hoping, just to really coalesce as much attention around this as possible, because I think that they're sort of worried about what happened with the Mueller report and how that sort of landed, of course, with the help of William Barr's letter that sort of laid out not so much a summary, but a version of what the report actually
That was
said.
A disgrace. That was a disgrace.
Yeah, so I think that that's what they're trying to avoid here, is to have this sort of be something that hits people over the head and really gets the point home about the president's role on January 6th and, you know, the violence that we saw that day, as well as Carol's talked about, what these legal efforts that led up to January 6th.
Okay, well, we're still, I'm hoping for a smoking gun. You guys have been covering this very closely. What would count as a smoking gun?
I think there are two things that could count. One would be the president's own words, whether repeated by somebody who stood right next to him or in some other fashion. The president's own words playing some role in encouraging the attack on the Capitol. And, you know, we know what he did say because it was on a loudspeaker at the Ellipse. But anything that goes beyond that, those words, which were, you know,
He's got away with that.
Let's go up to the Capitol and fight like hell for your country, or you're not going to have a country left, you know. But if there was the words of the president himself, the former president, saying his goal, his wish of what would happen. You may remember, Al, that Mo Brooks was described by Ali Alexander. Remember, one of the protest organizers, Ali Alexander, had said he had a plot that he was cooking up with some Republican lawmakers in the Freedom Caucus to exert what he called maximum pressure on Republicans who at that point were not resisting the blockade of the certification on January 6th. And Ali Alexander talked about exerting this maximum pressure with people on the streets outside the Capitol, applying this pressure on the inside. And that sure sounds like what we saw, right? The day of, although there was a lot more violence the day of than that description. So if the president had been aware of Ali Alexander's plan and saying, you go get them, guys, you go do that, I think that would be a pretty big smoking gun. I'm not saying it exists. I'm saying that if it does, that would be a pretty big deal.
Politically, it could be a big deal. But, you know, the other side of that is, legally, would it be? Because I think that some of these are really tough questions. And I know that sometimes upsets people when you talk about the legal restrictions here. But there's a First Amendment protected right to assemble. There's a First Amendment even in support of complete lies about a stolen election. So, you know, if there was organization in terms of maximizing pressure, right, or even when they use the, you know, the phrase fight like hell, that's kind of in the realm of political speech, right? That doesn't necessarily mean actually physically fight people, but, you know, that those are a lot of the, yes, they did. They did. That's how certainly it was interpreted. But, and I mean, that was sort of the logical outcome of this to a certain extent. But criminally, I do think it's a minefield, certainly for DOJ, in terms of January 6th itself, trying to come up with a potential criminal charge against Trump, absent some sort of smoking gun.
What about the 3 hours that he sat there and seemed to relish what was going on? And didn't send what he finally did, make a video saying, go, you know.
And that those video, the versions of that video could be very interesting, because apparently it's filmed multiple times. So, because he didn't hit the right note, I suppose, the
I
first
love
few
you.
Times.
You're great. Don't go. No, Mr. President. No, that's not the message. Oh, what you're doing is great. Hang Mike Pence. No, Mr. President. No, no, no. You're telling him to go. Really? You know, I mean, what? It would be nice to get those. But aren't there other witnesses there, too? I mean, and including, is Ivanka going to testify. She was there.
Well, she testified to the committee. So, and yeah. as did Jared. So that's certainly.
Yeah. Dad was really liking the idea of hanging Mike Pence.
I could be putting myself out on a limb here, but I kind of doubt you're going to see Ivanka testify in person. But I can imagine that some of her testimony behind closed doors will be replayed. And you know, she is the person in those moments, along with Mark Meadows, who are pleading with her father to remake the video, to do another take, you know, to take down the tweet that he issues sometime after 2 o'clock, in which he accuses Vice President Pence of lacking the courage, essentially blaming him for the rain of violence that's coming down on him and has forced him and his Secret Service detail to scurry down to the basement for protection. So she is a critical witness, as is Mark Meadows, but I would guess.
So yeah, so having her there could be counterproductive because she loves her father.
And you can just sort of do a highlight reel, right? It's a little bit of a time saving device, because you can just sort of highlight the most important components without necessarily having this, you know, lengthy testimony that drags on. They can basically edit down and get to the most essential parts by using some of these interviews that they've already done.
And the people who were there who witnessed him saying, "I kind of like the idea of hanging Mike Pence."
I think you'll definitely hear from a person who heard Meadows say that. Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, told another aide, you know, "Oh my goodness, I'm making up the words here, but oh my goodness, the president seems to like this."
Okay, like this meaning the whole thing, or liking specifically
that his supporters are after Pence.
Boy, oh boy, Pence was very loyal to him, wasn't he, all the way through until
that day.
Yeah, and that's a hanging offense.
Things could have gone a lot differently if Mike Pence hadn't been, you know, a lot of people call him like the wax museum vice president, because for 4 years he sat beside Donald Trump and smiled blandly and nodded and said how great this president was.
I didn't think it was so bland. I thought he had an electric smile.
Okay. So, but here on that day, he dug in his heels. He refused to leave and went, and he acted more like the commander in chief that day than the president did. You know, he worked with the Army, conferring with the Secretary of Defense and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs about how to clear the Capitol and return essentially to what he called to finish the job of certifying the election and to keep democracy from popping off the roller coaster rails.
Okay. So are you guys going to be like having popcorn and like watching this thing? Where do you watch this thing?
Just in my little office at the Washington Post.
Well, you go to work.
It'll be late night if we're doing these primetime specials, you know.
Right. Where will you be, Al?
I think I'll just be at home, you know, on the couch going like, "Oh, come on, come on." That'll be, I'll be doing that kind of thing, I guess.
It'll be interesting because I think that like for people, reporters who've been in this so deep, it is going to be really interesting to find out if there's still stuff that they were able to keep really close to the vest, if they were able to keep those secrets up.
If they were smart, they did. I hope there are 12 Alexander Butterfield moments.
Mm.
Remember Alexander Butterfield? For my listeners who aren't old enough, Alexander Butterfield testified at the Watergate hearing. And they had, of course, done a pre-interview with him. And he sits down and he says, "Yeah, everything that he said in the Oval Office was taped."
Yeah, that was a huge moment for the committee. And he didn't want to give that up, but he didn't want to lie. And when they asked him point blank, "How did you get verbatim what the president said?" he finally had to answer.
And then I just remember I was watching and that moment. And I just jumped off. This is what I'm hoping that happens in these hearings, that I jumped off the couch and I went, "That's it. It's over." Because if it's taped, it's not good for the president. I mean, it's got to be horrible, and it's over.
That was the end.
So I do think they have saved some stuff for this. They better have. Otherwise, they don't, you know, what prosecution doesn't save stuff?
Well, of course, they're going to have some what they consider to be some new bombshells, or else Raskin would not have said, you know, blow the roof off the house. But, you know, to the point we've all three been making, bombshells may only create more cringe and disdain within a certain portion of the American public. And there will be a lot, potentially a very large percentage of Americans who say, so what, as they've said for the last 4 years, because they really think of Donald Trump as their champion and they really like what he has to say. And though he did not deliver for them on policies that protected his supporters or lifted them up, they like him. And it's really hard for them to absorb or acknowledge that he's done a lot of things that would get normal people in jail pretty quickly.
That's been something that's been really tough for January 6th defendants to admit themselves. And there's somewhat of a split where you have some defendants pleading guilty, but not really acknowledging that they got tricked, right? But you do have a lot of defendants who now realize that they threw their lives away to a certain extent because they believed in the lies about the stolen election. That has been really fascinating to watch some of the defendants come to recognize that they were tricked, and this is the rest of their lives. Some of them are going to be left with felony records, not be able to own guns, not be able to vote in some states because of what they did on January 6th.
Yeah, but that's only a few hundred people. And we're talking about all these people that will back Donald Trump no matter what. Well, there are a lot of us who think this is maybe one of the worst people in the world. And that's a divided country, isn't it?
Well, Al, I mean, think about the very beginning, the bookend to what we're discussing, right? January 6th is the end of the Trump presidency in many ways. But the beginning of the Trump presidency was when he was caught on a hot mic describing the way in which he could use his celebrity to grab women by the crotch and they wouldn't be able to complain or do anything about it. He was elected president by a majority, at least of the Electoral College, after those tapes became public. And it wasn't very soon before people had to go to the polls that they heard those tapes, sort of incontrovertible evidence about the way he thinks of women and talks in private.
Yeah. But then you had Comey and you had, you know, Hillary, who I think would have made a great president, calling Trump supporters a basket of deplorables. And I think she was calling basket of deplorables were a basket of bad attitudes, not the people. But that, of course, didn't matter. That canceled every other thing that Trump had said. And remember that Trump did lose by 3 million votes in the popular vote. And
he didn't accept that, though. He formed a whole commission to prove that wrong.
And then how many votes did the commission prove were falsely? none, right? They found nothing.
Yes, it was a platform for them to continue to, you know, rein in voting, essentially.
Did that make people skeptical when he said, oh, I really won this one? No, I'm just praying for these Alexander Butterfield moments. OK,
yeah. You know what I think is interesting about what you just said, Al, and your conversation with Ryan about the allegation of deplorables or people that resist hearing factual information about Donald Trump's activities as president and behavior as president. It says something about the way in which this group of Americans feel let down and ignored and dismissed by
resentment.
Yeah, there's a deep, deep resentment and a deep anger and distrust in this country. and it predated Donald Trump. It's, you know, we often say, Phil and I, my co-author, Phil Rucker, we often say, you know, Donald Trump not only tapped into the anger and fear and resentment in this group of Americans, he amped it up. He turned the dial as high as it could go. And that is his genius, because
it is.
He figured out there was a yearning in this country for something else, a feeling of anger. And we shouldn't deride this group of Americans who resist any criticism of Donald Trump, any factual information about Donald Trump's misdeeds. We should figure out what is it that they are so aggrieved about and feel that they need from this country that they're not getting.
Well, there's reason for that. People don't think the government works for them, and in many, many cases, it doesn't. I mean, if you look at, I believe a majority now of Trump voters want to raise taxes on people, upper income people.
Hmm.
And these are people who, you know, starting 10 years ago or so, were going like, wait a minute, my kids are not better off than I am.
That's right.
And that was the American, that was the deal.
That's it.
And remember, he's from Queens. Donald Trump's from a real estate developing company in Queens. If you want to resent the elites, come from Queens and resent Manhattan and the hoity-toities in Manhattan. No, he tapped into something that's actually real, that's actually legitimate. And it is that people aren't doing as well as their parents, or and their kids aren't doing as well as them. And people are mad about that. And that makes them susceptible to things like critical race theory and, you know, replacement, the great replacement theory, and all this horrible, horrible stuff, but also legitimate stuff, which is that the economy doesn't work.
Yeah. And the chasm between the haves and the have-nots is, you know, worse than it was in the 1920s.
The resentment of elites is very real and very legitimate. So there. And we're them. Okay.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.